So I've been thinking about this topic for several years now, and early on I was reminded of a childhood memory that I had where I was around the age of somewhere between around 10 or 11, sitting by a window, slightly bored, watching the rain against the window pane. And suddenly some thoughts came into my head. Why can I think? Why do I exist? Why am I a conscious being? And I wasn't raised in a religious home. I became a Christian as an adult, but these questions seem to come from nowhere. There is something that it means to be human. Perhaps the philosopher Descartes was right in saying the thing that we know with most certainty is that we are conscious beings. Or as the philosopher Thomas Nagel put it, there is something that it is like to be us. There is a you and there is a me. But what exactly are we? What exactly are human beings? And this is a question that people have been talking about for many centuries. Are we advanced apes? Are we machines? Do we have a soul? Are we a soul trapped in a body waiting to float off to heaven? And the question, what is a human being, asks a question of identity. What is it that makes you, you? And of course, there are many different answers to that, depending on who you ask. And today we want to look at the line of thought that says the thing that makes you, you, is your brain. Your brain defines you. The choices that you make, the personality that you have, the behaviors that you exhibit, even the religious beliefs that you may or may not hold, are all dictated by the activity in your brain. And of course, we live in an age of neuroscience, where neuroscience is uncovering more and more about the structure and function of the human brain. I spent over 10 years in the field of functional MRI, looking at lots of different brain networks corresponding to, at one point I was looking at human cocaine addiction, and I've looked at a few different things in that area. Brain imaging is a fascinating area, and the field of neuroscience continues to accelerate. We've moved on from the Human Genome Project. We are now working on the Human Connectome Project, or rather neuroscientists are. And that is an attempt to understand the connection between every neural pathway in the brain, which seems like an extraordinary undertaking to me. And there are even those that are looking at the intersection of neuroscience with theology, what happens in the brain when people pray. And this is a fascinating area of intersection. And of course, this is all wonderful and extremely elegant. And I loved my time in this field. But do the discoveries of neuroscience mean that everything that it is to be a human being is entirely driven by the brain? And there are some brilliant scientists that believe this. Francis Crick, who is famous for co-discovering the DNA double helix and won the joint Nobel Prize in 1962, said this later on. He said, "You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. As Lewis Carroll might have phrased it, you're nothing but a pack of neurons." I wonder how you feel about this view. Is this the best story that can be told about human identity? And of course, there are implications for this view, not least, I know that there's at least one person working in the field of AI, and the arrival of ChatGPT has thrown us into a quandary, and clearly levels of intelligence and capabilities in AI are accelerating all the time. But what about human consciousness? Is the ability to process information the same thing as, will there one day be conscious androids walking the streets? And of course, what you believe about what a human being is impacts how you answer that question. But at the heart of this whole conversation, it's really important to say early on, there are actually two different things at play. Yes, we have the brain with its neurons and synapses and chemicals and electrical activity. But we also have the mind with all of its thoughts and feelings and emotions and memories and decisions. And so another important question we need to ask is, what is the relationship between the mind and the brain? And this is not a new question that neuroscience has forced us to look at. This is a question that people have been debating for centuries, maybe in the form of the body-soul problem in the ancient world, but it's the same fundamental thing. How do you get from neurons in your head to what it is like to be you, the inner life that you have, the thoughts in your mind? Is it even possible? Or, as Baroness Susan Greenfield put it, and listen to her language, she is an agnostic, not a theist. How does the water of boring old brain cells and sludgy stuff translate into the wine of phenomenological subjective experience? How do you get from water to wine? And there are many agnostics and atheists, as well as Christian theists, that recognize this is a hard problem to solve. So much so that David Chalmers, an Australian professor of philosophy, has coined it the hard problem of consciousness. Easy problems are where you're looking at the brain network structures and functions that turn on and off when you move from one state of consciousness to another. For example, moving from being awake to being asleep. But the hard problem is looking at how on earth you explain how you get from neurons to what it is like to be you. And he calls this the hard problem of consciousness. And the perspective driving some of this discussion is that mind and brain are essentially the same thing. Mental states are reducible to brain states, hence the term reductive physicalism. The mind can be reduced to physical processes in the brain. Mental processes are brain processes, which is another way of saying there isn't really anything that it is like to be you. There is just your brain. There is brain activity. But surely this is an absurd way of thinking about human beings. Firstly, at the level of logic, it is incoherent. The person wanting to express the view is saying, my first person perspective is that there is no first person perspective. And of course, we see that this collapses into incoherence. Secondly, on a very practical level, we don't live as though there's nothing that it is to be us. We live as though we each have a genuine experience of the world that is to be taken seriously, and we believe others have it too. When we get passionate about social justice and human rights and human trafficking and institutional racism and all of the other aspects of life, we do that precisely because we believe the people involved are not simply packs of neurons, but conscious beings who experience suffering. And so chalking it all down to brain chemicals doesn't seem to be enough. Let me say a bit more about why that is the case. Imagine I were to ask you to describe to me the smell of coffee. And all we have to work with are physical processes, because if God doesn't exist and we live in a material universe entirely, all you have to work with are physical descriptions. So what would you say? Well, you might offer me the chemical structure of caffeine, but that doesn't get you any closer to the smell of coffee. Or you might describe to me the the physiology that happens as you drink this coffee and digest it. But that doesn't get me any closer to the smell of coffee. If you want to understand the smell of coffee, you need to smell it. There's actually no other way to access this phenomenon. And this is an example of, in the singular, a quail, or in its plural, qualia. And qualia are qualitative experiences that are impossible to describe physically. Physical descriptions cannot get you to qualia. And life is full of qualia. We encounter qualia all the time. And perhaps the biggest qualia of all is the experience of what it is to be you. Just to put it one other way, imagine we wanted to do an experiment to find out what it's like for you to go through your next review at work or sit your next exam. And we could collect some very interesting data from your brain using EEG, using structural MRI, using functional MRI. But would that tell us what it's like for you to go through the review and cope with pressure and stress and expectations and all of that? It wouldn't. In order to find out what it was like for you, we need to ask you. Measurements from your brain don't give us that. We actually need to ask you in order to access your mind. And so for this reason, many scientists and philosophers, agnostics and atheists, as well as theists, believe that brain processes and conscious experience are actually two very different things. They're fundamentally different. And what the science has shown us is that mind and brain are connected. When you use your mind, your brain is involved. Clearly they are connected. But just because mind and brain are connected does not necessarily mean they are identical. It doesn't mean that one collapses onto the other. And so on. And so what I'd like to do for the next section of the talk is to go through some other ways of describing the relationship between mind and brain that some other philosophers and scientists hold to. One view is that the mind emerges from the brain. And this view says that the brain generates the mind, when a number of component parts come together, something new comes into being that is not reducible to physics and chemistry. And so this view is known as non-reductive physicalism. So the mind is still a derivative from the physical brain, but it can't be reduced to physics and chemistry. And this view is trying to make sense of observations in science and from the clinic, that these two things are connected and integrated. A way of illustrating this might be to think about a movie. A movie, pick the one you like. I just chose Avengers. I'm not a fan, actually, particularly. I don't mind them. But a movie has a number of building blocks. It has a script, it has a cast, it has a director, it has a soundtrack, it has a camera crew, and so on. All of those building blocks are essential to the film. If you remove any one of them, the film doesn't exist in the same way. However, we experience the film. We don't go to the cinema and think about the building blocks. We experience it as a whole. There's something new that emerges when you put them all together. And that's a little bit like what this view is saying. And one proponent of this view is Nancy Murphy, Associate Professor of Christian Philosophy at Fuller, who has written a number of books. And in one book, she describes this view as an attempt to establish a perspective on human nature that would allow for greater resonance between science and faith. Our core theme is a monistic or holistic view of humans. She doesn't mean monistic in an Eastern sense, merely in terms of there being one substance that accounts for the mind. There are statements about the physical nature of human beings made from the perspective of biology or neuroscience are about exactly the same entity as statements made about the spiritual nature of persons from the point of view of theology or religious traditions. So, yeah, theological perspectives and scientific are just different ways of looking at the same phenomenon. Now, the challenge for proponents of this view is how exactly do physical processes generate experience? We still come up against the hard problem. Just because you put the word generate or emerge in there still doesn't get you away from the fact that how do you get experiential things from physical processes in the brain? Now, of course, Christian theists believe we have more to work with than simply matter, because God exists, and that is partly how they get around this problem, that the system isn't a closed one, and so there's information going in that helps you cross the chasm from brain to mind. Some people make the point, though, that even growing, because some people say that when things become more and more complex, that's how mind emerges from brain. But people like Ian McGilchrist make the point that even complexity isn't enough to explain consciousness. Just because you have areas of very complex neuronal connectivity doesn't itself enough provide an argument. He says, for example, there are thought to be an astonishing 16 to 26 billion neurons in the cerebral cortex, but there are a staggering 69 to 101 billion neurons in the cerebellum. These include Purkinje cells, some of the largest and most profusely connected cells in the nervous system, and yet the cerebellum is completely incapable of supporting self-awareness. There are areas of the brain that are extremely complex, but they don't support consciousness, whereas other areas are less complex and they do support it. So complexity alone is not enough, according to some people. He also makes the point, I'm not going to read this one out, but I think you have it in your PowerPoint, that we don't even know what matter is. You know, the more that quantum physics develops, and the less and less we realize we actually know about the nature of matter, and yet here we are relying upon it to explain something as complex as human consciousness. Something that's really important to say in this area is that people are, the difference between scientific inference and a philosophical interpretation of the data. This is an example of the cover of Scientific American in 2017, where it has this very enticing main title, How the Mind Arises. Excellent. Let's have a look. And then underneath that, the strap line, network interactions in the brain create thought. Now tell me, is there a scientific study that you can do that will enable you to draw the conclusion that network interactions in the brain create thought? The truth is, there is not. The science, what does the science tell you? It tells you that network interactions in the brain correlate with thought, they're connected. It doesn't tell you that one creates the other. If you want to draw that conclusion, you have brought a particular belief system or philosophical perspective onto the scientific data and drawn a conclusion. And we see this all the time in a scientific context, philosophical statements being made that go beyond what the data can tell us. It's very important to be aware of this in this field. What can the data tell us? What is a philosophical imposition on that data? And make a distinction between the two. So that's an important thing. And then another mind-body position is to say that the mind is beyond the brain, that there are actually two kinds of substance. The mind is a non-physical substance, and the brain is a physical substance, and these two are distinct, but they interact. So they're distinct in that they can exist independently of the other, whereas with the previous view, when the brain dies, the mind dies. but in this view, the mind can continue to exist without the brain. Traceable to the ancient world via, Plato and others, also voiced in the 17th century by the mathematician and philosopher René Descartes, his iconic cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The thing that's most fundamental about us is that we are a mind. And it's held by a number of key philosophers and scientists today. Sir John Eccles, a neurophysiologist, philosopher and Nobel laureate, said that we have to recognize that we are spiritual beings with souls existing in a spiritual world, as well as material beings with bodies and brains existing in a material world. Or we could look at J.P. Moreland, a well-known philosopher today, who says that the brain is a physical substance that has physical properties, and the mind or soul is a mental substance that has mental properties. The soul and brain can interact with each other. They are different substances with different properties. And so this view is saying, look, humans can't simply be explained in terms of physical systems. There is also a non-physical dimension. There's a physical brain and a non-physical mind. But of course, the question that proponents of this view, and it's known as substance dualism, two substances, people with this view have to respond to the question, how exactly does a non-physical mind interact with a physical brain? Especially when the sciences show them, it seems like it's so physical. How do we incorporate a non-physical entity into that? Another view that we hear is that mind is fundamental. So this view actually turns the whole conversation on its head. So far we've been looking at how do you get mind from brain. This flips it on its head and says, you'll never be able to do that. There are a number of shortcomings. Why don't we start with mind and try and build a bridge back to the brain? What if mind is fundamental to life? And this view is known as panpsychism, which comes from the Greek pan meaning all and psyche meaning soul. And this view basically says there are levels of consciousness in every living thing, from humans down through the animal system hierarchy, down to also inanimate objects, and even down to the the atomic scale. Someone like, a proponent is David Chalmers, experience as fundamental, a constructive theory of experience. And Philip Goff, who would describe electrons and quarks even as having unimaginably simple forms of experience. And this is a fascinating view, one that I think as Christian theists it's helpful to us because it actually puts mind back on the table as something that might be fundamental to life. And that actually is not a million miles away from a biblical perspective on human makeup. But the challenges of this view is, well, firstly, how do you explain the difference between humans and even the most advanced primate? There still seems to be a very, very different level of consciousness that Homo sapiens has, that humans made in the image of God have. How do we make sense of that? There's also a question around, we don't have 3 trillion conscious experiences coming from all the atoms in our body. We have one. Consciousness is unified. You just have one conscious experience. So how do you make sense of that? So there are challenges to be faced in this view as well. Moving on, another angle that can be helpful to us in responding to the view, are we just our brains, is to start to look at clinical data. When you start to look at patients and people what do you see? And when you start to do that, you see that human beings are very complex, and there are some unusual phenomena in the world that certainly make no sense if we are just our brains. One of those data sets is that of near-death experiences, which has arisen since we've had the ability to resuscitate people in a medical setting. Since the late 60s, we've been able to do that. So a lot of patients that go into cardiac arrest have a time of being in a state of clinical death, but then are resuscitated. And doctors began to have their patients come and say, when I was being resuscitated, or before that, in fact, after my heart had stopped, I actually was very vividly conscious and had a perspective on, and I was able to, you know, see. And and so there are all kinds of accounts, and we've perhaps watched some YouTube videos or documentaries on this, just to say that, of course, it can, you know, there are question marks over whether some accounts could be fabricated, and of course they could be, but there has been a systematic collection of data for over 50 years by clinicians and cardiologists who have nothing to gain by investigating it, but patients kept coming to them and reporting this, so they decided to look into it. It seems that around 7 to 10% of patients that are resuscitated report some sort of near-death experience. What do we do with this? And what do we do with this as Christians? Is this evidence that the mind can exist without the brain? Is it an indicator from the clinic of that there is life beyond the death of our physical bodies? I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there to say that when you look at people, it's complicated. There are particularly some interesting stories of people who used to be a physicalist but then had their own near-death experience. We could look at Dr. Eben Alexander, who was a former Harvard neurosurgeon. His patients used to come to him and say they'd had these experiences during surgery, and he would kind of dismiss it until he himself had a severe bacterial meningitis at the age of 54 and was in a coma for 7 days. And was expected to die. His entire cortex, the areas of the brain known to be involved in recruited in consciousness, were not working at all, that shut down. And he was, he extraordinarily did survive, and goes on to describe this very vivid conscious experience, including meeting a sister he didn't know he had that had died earlier in life before he had met her, but he could describe her perfectly from this conscious, this near-death experience. And when was shown a photo, it was a match. Fascinating, right? And when we want to try and answer questions of human identity, we need to be looking at the full scope of human experience and clinical observation, because when you look at people, it gets complicated. And there, even if there was only one genuine account of this, that surely gives us pause for thought in light of the view that you are just your brain. If you are just your brain, when the brain dies, that ought to be the end of human consciousness. So let's just change gear for the last section of the talk to say that let's just ask a slightly different question. Even if all of our questions about the scientific workings of the mind and its relationship to the brain are answered, even if we come up with an elegant neuroscience of consciousness, that will not have answered all of our questions. There are still some questions that remain unanswered. Questions like the one I asked as a child, sitting looking out of the window. Why are we conscious at all? Why do we have a mind at all? And as David Chalmers said, there's a difference between finding a neural correlate, which is what scientists are looking for, and finding an explanation. Why are we even here as conscious beings? And what is the best explanation? If God doesn't exist, human consciousness is a bit of an anomaly. It's surprising because we're here in a non-conscious universe of time plus matter plus chance, and somehow conscious beings have emerged from that system. But if God does exist, then in a way it's entirely expected, or it certainly makes much more sense, because if God exists, then consciousness has been fundamental to the universe. Because as we know, before there was anything material, there was God, a conscious being in a conscious community of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The very first sentence of the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Or the opening verses of John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. Or we could look at the I Am of the Judeo-Christian tradition when Yahweh speaks to Moses. It's the I Am that we hear about. And so if God exists, then we didn't start with matter. We started with the mind of God. We started with a personal, mindful God. And if that is true, then we have grounds for making sense of the human mind. And there is hope for solving the hard problem of consciousness. We are made in the image of this God, and therefore we have a mind because God has a mind. We think because God thinks. We are conscious because God is himself a conscious thinking being. And of course, there's a whole other areas to think about as well, because of what it means to be born again and have the mind of Christ, which is that sort of sits on top of everything that I've said so far. We don't have time to go into that. But where do I want to land? Well, it is that if it's true that we're made in the image of this God, then there's an identity to us that runs much deeper than the activity of our brains. We are so much more than our brains. We are so much more than machines. Human beings are sacred and have immeasurable value and worth. And that value and worth doesn't change even if our brain and our mind changes. And there's this wonderful verse that again in a way describes the dualism that we've been thinking about. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day, and therefore we do not lose heart.